Good evening. The nation readies itself for the first presidential debate scheduled for tonight at 8 p.m. The president's taxes, what do we know about Trump and his mysterious backers? And a Palestinian event is blocked by a social media giant while the first day of school harkens in the age of COVID. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. It's a pivotal moment in arguably one of the most important presidential elections in United States history. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden will not be shaking hands and won't be making opening statements either. Instead, they'll barrel into a bitter argument over the future of the country. At the top of the hot button issues, COVID-19. It's taken 100,000 lives in the United States, 1 million deaths worldwide, and another outbreak is apparently brewing. Biden will step onto the Cleveland stage holding leads in the polls, but the former Veep faces a withering attack from a president who knows how to belittle his opponents. One issue sure to be heard, personal income tax. Joe Biden made his tax returns public months ago. Trump's returns have been plastered across the front page of the New York Times all week, with reports of dodges, massive losses, and shadowy European lenders. Trump's taxes show a man on the ropes. Facing hundreds of million dollars coming due apparently during his second term, that is, if Trump is reelected in November. An investigator who specializes in corporate tax avoidance is James Henry. He's been researching Trump's investments for several years. Henry says Trump's another shady character in the world of finance who just happens to be president of the United States.
A lot of billionaires in the United States don't pay taxes. I mean, we've had something like $845 billion of market value gain for the top 643 billionaires in the United States just since March 2020. That's unrealized wealth, but they're not paying any taxes on it. We don't tax wealth in this country. We tax income. And Trump's tax returns show just how spongy that concept is of income when you have all these games you can play with tax returns. We had previous reports from the Times. Clearly, he didn't pay any taxes in the 70s and 80s and 90s to speak of. The only tax years that he paid anything since 2000 were 2005 through 2009. And then he got a huge tax refund of about $74 million. And there's a lot of questions that the IRS has about why he did that. But the IRS is under a lot of financial pressure. It's had 30% cut in its auditing staff since 2011. Republicans in the Senate have basically emptied out the IRS auditing staff for criminal enforcement. And so they are working very slowly on this case. They are now devoting more audits to poor people than they are to rich people in the United States. The head of the criminal enforcement division admitted that.
The recent release of documents that showed FinCEN was basically allowing money laundering to go on for decades.
One of the big policy questions we have here is the role of institutions like Deutsche Bank and other international private banks in facilitating this stuff. You know, Trump's largest creditor for years has been Deutsche Bank, a bank that was deeply implicated in money laundering for Russia. We're just beginning to learn now in the FinCEN papers that they had more than $1.5 billion of suspicious activity reports that they never followed up on at Deutsche Bank. Enablers who basically have facilitated this kind of activity for decades. So we can get all upset about Donald Trump and his family's behavior, but I think in the background here, there's a lot of other enablers who are law firms and accounting firms and major banks like Deutsche Bank that were deeply involved in helping him to be a serial tax dodger. This is going to resonate with a lot of ordinary Americans. 73% of Americans earn less than $50,000. A majority of them have less than $1,000 in the bank. And they're paying taxes. Voluntary tax compliance in the United States has always been very high.
It could be that, as one of his advisors said to a reporter, well, yeah, that's what he put down, but they're going to obviously negotiate another number that'll be a lot more than that. And we're just unfair to hold that, you know, his initial offer to the IRS.
Putting the IRS and all of our institutions through, you know, this elaborate negotiation, that's not a privilege that most Americans enjoy. You know, we're expected to comply with the tax code and to put the right numbers down to begin with. When he's complaining about, well, I paid a lot of Social Security taxes, that's for a service. You know, he will be able to retire on Social Security.
Putin would not have gotten involved with such a low class individual as Donald Trump.
Trump's key Russia and former Soviet Union connections were all private connections. They were private oligarchs who were investing in his properties. There's more to it than that. It's likely that Putin has a certain amount of buyer's regret here. There's no doubt that he supported Trump's selection, but as Mueller found, it wasn't at the level of conscious conspiracy. They had the major contribution that Russia made to Donald Trump was financing his rise, and that was a question of oligarchs and not of necessarily of Putin. I'm not sure how much time the country wants to spend on this after the election. All of Trump's investments were handled through LLCs, and you know, you just don't know who was investing in those LLCs. The Russia aspect. I think the most important lessons to draw from this is we have elected a guy who basically has no compunction about using every trick in the book to basically serve himself at a time when he's preaching law and order around the country. He's paying far less taxes than his undocumented workers are.
James Henry is an investigator who specializes in corporate tax avoidance. And the FBI and United States Department of Homeland Security are warning that violent domestic extremists pose a threat to the presidential election next month amid what one official called a witch's brew of rising political tensions, civil unrest, and foreign disinformation campaigns. Although the feds kept the warning low-key, the state of New Jersey published the warning on its Homeland Security website. A Homeland Security memo in August said ideologically driven extremists and other actors could quickly mobilize to engage in violence related to the election. The memo said the lone offender, white supremacists, and other lone offenders with personalized ideologies pose the greatest threat of deadly violence. The Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, a bipartisan think tank, said in a June report that the outcome of the election could incite violence by the far right or far left. And last week, a group of Palestinian and Jewish activists who gathered for a Zoom conference featuring a well-known Palestinian feminist with a militant backstory found themselves banned from the online meeting application. Later, they were also banned from Facebook and YouTube. All the social media sites claim the guest, Leila Khalid, was part of a sanctioned Palestinian group known as the PFLP. A Marxist organization linked to the hijacking of several passenger jets in the 1960s and 70s. Khalid was reportedly involved in two of the hijackings. But organizers of the Zoom event say they were shut down because of a right-wing legal group known as Lawfare, part of a plot to silence Palestinian voices and the voices of progressive Jewish supporters and others. Among the invited speakers besides Leila Khalid was Ronnie Kasrils, a militant member of the South African National Congress when the group was in exile and its leader Nelson Mandela in prison, and Laura Whitehorn, a former political prisoner in the United States, as well as former Black Panther Sekou Odinga, who had spent 50 years in prison. Dr. Rabab Abulhadi is founding director and senior scholar of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies Program at San Francisco State University.
They claim that we would be engaging in something called the material support for terrorism. And we had actually discussed it with multiple lawyers, civil rights lawyers, and so on. Everybody said that this is not the case. That's not what you're doing. You're not paying money to the speakers. You're not doing anything to facilitate and engage in material support for terrorism, and so on. We told that to the university. We had lawyers who told that to the university. Nonetheless, university provost emailed us both and said, you might be engaged in criminal activity, which might lead to imprisonment. We were quite concerned, and so we contacted the lawyers again. And the lawyers wrote to the university saying that is not true. They're not violating any of the laws. They're holding a classroom. They're holding classroom. They're holding guest speakers. And it's their right to be able to invite any speakers they want to their classrooms. Classrooms do not imply any kind of agreement or disagreement with the speaker. We also, on the morning of, we also emailed the university provost again, and we said, it is your responsibility as a university to uphold your obligation to our classrooms, to allow us to be able to move on, not to cancel the classrooms. That would be a huge disservice to academic freedom, to us as faculty, and to our students who would be deprived from doing it at the last minute. Give us another platform. If Zoom is not going to do it, we need another platform. And we also need you to give us the names of all these 1,400 people that basically when Zoom canceled it, all the names disappeared. We want to get in touch with people and say if we can hold it on another platform. And sure enough, she didn't respond at all. Radio silence completely from the university. And so we started with the webinar. Of course, Zoom had already censored us. We started on a different platform. And then Facebook went and basically shut us down. Sent a message, threatening message to every single group that was going to carry the webinar live, and many groups, as I told you, were interested, and basically took down even the event announcement that we had on our Facebook page. And then, so we started carrying it on YouTube, then YouTube shut us down, then we moved to our other platform. Now this was a platform by the Students for Justice in Palestine, and YouTube shut us down again. We continued the webinar without being live. And now we have a campaign to uphold Zoom accountable. We have a campaign to uphold the university accountable from supporting us for our academic freedom, for deferring to Zoom to decide what the content of the classrooms.
They say that she's a member of the PFLP, and that's a sanctioned group. Is that true?
It is a sanctioned group by the State Department, but let's not forget that Nelson Mandela was also considered a terrorist. Who decides what terrorism is at any particular time is up to whoever is in power and who's telling the history. She argues that this is something that's part of resistance. This is part of the Palestinian story. But for us also is that when they said, are you hosting a member of the PFLP? I said, we're inviting her because she's a historical vicar that is so much all over women's studies, gender studies, historical studies, third world, Palestine. So she's everywhere. And there's films made about her. There are videos, there are interviews about her all over the internet. If we wanted to invite a group, one Palestinian group, or another, we will invite all of them and have a different kind of discussion. This was not the goal or the purpose of this webinar. But one of the things that has happened with the Israel groups is that they do not want any Palestinian narratives to be told. I mean, this is really the end result of it. And they've been in a frenzy. I mean, really trying to silence us and so on. And what happened is their attacks actually popularized the event more. I mean, even people who haven't heard about it. We were shut down before we even had a chance to. So they really want to claim that they actually are the only ones who represent Jewishness. And I always ask the question, who owns Jewishness? You don't. I'm sorry. There are many people historically, even before Zionism emerged, and will continue after Zionism has lost its support and so on, who speak, who have different responses to how do you fight against anti-Semitism, to the fact that there are many Jews who are against Zionism.
Dr. Rabab Abu Hadi is founding director and senior scholar of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies Program at San Francisco State University. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thousands of New York City elementary public school students returned to classes Tuesday amid reports of new coronavirus outbreaks in Brooklyn and Queens. Many students faced empty seats. And there's also been a sudden spike in people testing positive for the disease. Mayor de Blasio said today the positive test rate had climbed over 3% for the first time in weeks. De Blasio announced that people who refuse to wear masks in the hardest hit neighborhoods will be fined, and private schools in those areas that refuse to adhere to social distancing requirements could be closed. The hardest hit neighborhoods are home to many Orthodox Jews. Some have been resistant to social distancing and wearing masks. Similar clusters have also been reported in Rockland County, where there is also a large population of Orthodox Jewish people. Fears of an outbreak in schools and a perceived lack of focus by Mayor de Blasio led the Council of School Supervisors and Administrators, the Principals Union, to vote no confidence in the mayor over the weekend. Union President Mark Cannizzaro.
All summer long, we've been running into roadblock after roadblock with changing guidance, confusing guidance, sometimes no guidance. And when there's been no guidance, we've done what we could to fill in the gaps, only to later get different guidance, which has caused us to reprogram schools and go back to the drawing board. So the frustration and the difficulty is immense. We are still 100% supportive of trying to open our schools in the best possible way we can. Our principals will be there on Tuesday. Our teachers we know will be there on Tuesday. And we're going to do everything we can to make the children's experience the best it possibly can. And then the same thing will happen again on Thursday when our high school folks come in. Our District 75 and pre-K and 3K teams have already been in the entire week last week. And they've done what they could to make the best possible experience for their children as well. But our members voted unanimously. They felt that this was a necessary step to take. We certainly will continue to try to work to the best of our ability with the mayor and with the chancellor to make things better. But we just felt that we had to make a public statement at this point, because this past week, too many repeat errors occurred, and we need to be able to do better by our folks so that they can do better by children.
Union President Mark Cannizzaro. Part of the controversy is a deal between the mayor and the United Federation of Teachers. Its leader, Mike Mulgrew, was at PS15 on the Lower East Side this morning. He says the principals knew the deal and the decision was not political.
Everything goes on the table. And I know that makes people uncomfortable when we say those things, but it's a fact. We cannot allow politics to get in the way of our safety concerns at this point in time.
Mulgrew said the conversations with the mayor were public.
There was no such thing as a secret deal. Conversations were had by all the organizations. But I also share the frustration of the principals union of CSA. If the mayor would have listened in April and started planning with us in April, these issues would not have happened. It was the rush. It was the fact that City Hall made the decision to not engage in the opening of their schools until July. And I've been very clear with that. And I understand the frustration of the principals union and of the principals in the city, because it should have been done smoother. That's why we went and pushed back another week when it was clear to us that the schools were not ready to be open. So I understand their frustration, and I wish it would have been done in a better way, but that was a decision on City Hall. What we're monitoring for today is to make sure that, as of last night, reported to both us and CSA, that there is somebody assigned for every classroom and every fully remote teacher, every fully remote classroom in the city. All the safety issues have been, all the deliveries have happened. The ventilation checks continue constantly. We are sending people constantly for any sort of issue or complaint from a school for ventilation. But this could have been done much smoother.
The UFT had agreed that the principals are key to parents showing up.
If the parents don't have faith in the school, it's not even about the principal. If the parents don't have faith that their school is safe, then they won't have their children go there. That just is common sense to me. That's why it's important that we have staffs like the staff here who are doing all of this communication with the parents, talking to them constantly and letting them know that you can see that they've done everything. If you walk through this building, they're using exits and entrances in a very creative way. They're doing everything that needs to be done. And it was clear that they set up their plan that safety was the main concern, because if they can tell the parents the school is safe, the parents will believe them. So I agree with the premise.
And Mulgrew insisted, yes, it's about safety yet again.
If it's a safety issue, it has to be solved within hours. It's really that simple. There is no time to go through a bureaucracy. So when it comes to safety, you know, like right now as a city, we know what we've been through. We know what challenges we have. We're concerned right now with Brooklyn, clearly, right? So we're very concerned with Brooklyn. And if those area codes in Brooklyn, if we don't see those numbers start coming down by the end of the week, we're going to get much more aggressive with City Hall, because we can't have this. We're not going backwards. And we didn't go through all of this pain and suffering to once again start having our entire city be shut down. So I think we need to be always cautiously optimistic and at the same time aggressive on any sort of safety concerns.
But asked about the grade he'd give the mayor and education commissioner, the teachers union leader said his red pen is still on his desk.
I'll wait till I see all the schools opening for 2 weeks and functioning and check all the safety at that point. Until then, the homework is in progress.
And as the head of the United Federation of Teachers, Michael Mulgrew, the principals union head, Mark Cannizzaro, says the next big problem is getting the technology running for poor students.
We need to focus efforts on getting the devices in the kids' hands that need them. We need to focus efforts on trying to keep the students engaged who are from the least advantaged neighborhoods and communities. And that's something that is always, always, always the case. But you're right, there is a concern of a widening gap due to the coronavirus and the hybrid model and not being full-time in school. And that is something that our professionals are keenly aware of, and they will be doing everything they possibly can.
And that's Mark Conazzaro, the head of the Principals Union. A teacher at PS 15 on East 4th Street in Lower East Side held out hope for a great day.
Just so excited to have the children back in the building. I mean, that's why we're all here. It's going to be a great day. Thankful for good weather as well. It was supposed to rain this morning, and we're lining up here, so I'm glad things are dry.
Great. What do you teach?
I teach ESL, ENL.
Pre-K and some special education students were the first to return to New York City public schools today. Most middle and high school students were scheduled to return on Thursday. And finally, Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to close Rikers Island and replace it with four borough-based jails suffered a major setback following a judge's ruling that the city bypassed the legally mandated review process for its proposed Lower Manhattan jail. State Supreme Court Judge John Kelly issued the decision last Monday, siding with local Chinatown residents who filed a lawsuit against the jail's construction. The project would demolish both towers of the Manhattan detention complex known as the Tombs at 124 White Street and build a larger jail in the same lot. Residents have spent years organizing against the proposal, arguing that the 29-story building would threaten quality of life in their neighborhood. Christopher Marty is a local activist. He says they won the legal victory because of strong community turnout against the plan. Marty adds he supports jail reform, but not by building any more jails.
2 years ago, the mayor announced a plan to build four borough-based jails, one being specifically in the Chinatown community. We realized that no one in the community was even approached to start discussing. And what we did was we hosted town halls, teach-ins, we testified at the council office, at Manhattan Borough President's office. And what we really wanted to do at first was just educate the community around this development and the potential harm it's going to have for Lower Manhattan, but also to make sure that people understood that building new jails wasn't the right criminal justice reform that we needed, especially in this city. The city first wanted to develop a jail at 80 Center Street, and they conducted an environmental impact statement for that site. When they realized that that site wasn't going to be feasible, they switched it to 125 White Street and didn't do an EIS statement for that location. And they just stated since it was so close, they didn't have to redo it. And so they skipped their own process to make sure that this development would be safe, that the community would have an impact, which limited the voice of community members, which limited the voice of researchers, people who are conducting studies, not only construction studies, but traffic studies, light and shadow studies. All of it was ignored because the city wanted to move forward so quickly and irresponsibly with this development.
Did the judge say in the decision?
The judge said that this process was illegal because they didn't follow their own procedure and they didn't have a just process for the community to engage with it. And one of the things he highlighted was that they refused to do a contamination study of the air and how this construction will affect the seniors that live just right next to it, as well as how the impact it's going to have on traffic, small businesses, and the environment for years to come. He sent the city back to the drawing board and said, you have to redo this process and make sure you conduct an environmental impact statement and allow the communities to have a voice. It's a win for not only our community, but for residents citywide.
Who supported the jail?
Our council member was for the jail. She voted to support the development of these four based jails, the city as well, the mayor, the speaker. And there were a few nonprofits who saw this as we have to do anything to close Rikers Island and building new jails is the answer to it, which I totally disagree with. There's a lot of things we can do instead of building new jails. Once they realized that there was going to be community opposition, they needed to find some supporters within the community. And so they started cutting pretty much what I think backdoor deals with different nonprofits to say, we'll give you the funding that you've been asking for decades if you either stay silent when it comes to opposition against the jail or speak in favor of the jail.
And is that what happened?
That's what I believe happened. A lot of these conversations were done behind closed doors, and there was no transparency to see why certain organizations got funded.
So where does this go now?
There's no way they can make up for missing a whole environmental impact statement. And so it's going to be interesting to see what they write out and how they respond during the appeal process.
Yeah. It always seemed in the past, anyway, that once you had a community facility, you couldn't stop it.
And I think that's a testament to how well the community organized, bringing a lot of stakeholders in place to risk their businesses, their nonprofit, in opposition to this jail. You know, this wasn't kind of like a one organization fight. We got a lot of people to take a risk and stand up to the city and say, what are you doing here? Like, is this the future of our city? Is this the future of Chinatown?
What about jail reform?
Right now, there's only 4,300 incarcerated individuals in New York City jails. And this is due because of bail reform. This is a prime opportunity to say, how can we give the services, the needs, the help to these individuals who are in Rikers Island and in satellite jails? You know, pushing back against the city is always hard. This should give hope to everyone that's been fighting. I hope that people in this dark time that we're living in could get a glimmer of hope and say, wow, when we all work together, we can make real change in our community.
Christopher Marty is a Lower East Side activist. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 29th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Rebecca Miles. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul D'Arienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.